The rain report for August 11th, 2012 is coming to you in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with this rain report. Ever heard of the single signal problem? It was a major design issue in the 1930s and 40s in amateur radio circles. Martin Ewing, AA6E, an ARRL technical advisor, spoke about this issue as a preface to his talk about SDR, Software-Defined Radio Technology, at the 2012 Dayton Hamvention.
My name is Martin Ewing. I'm Alpha Alpha 6 Echo. I'm so-called ARRL technical advisor. You can ask me what that means. I'm not quite sure. But I am also a volunteer at the ARRL laboratory a few days a week, where I do various projects that are of mutual interest to me and to the lab. This is the Google Ngram service. It's something that Google provides where you can type in a phrase, any phrase you like, and it will tell you how often that appears in their digitized literature, which they have a huge data storage of all books that they've ever scanned. The term amateur wireless begins to show up around 1910 in their literature, peaks at around 1915, which is just when ARRL was founded and QST began. Then the term amateur radio takes over in 1920 or so. So, you know, our hobby, as we all know, is a very young hobby. It's only about 100 years old. What we should all be celebrating here, and so far as I know, I'm the only one speaking here at Dayton about the history of amateur radio at all. This is the 100th anniversary of the first United States Radio Act, the Radio Act of 1912. That was the first time amateur radio ever appeared in legislation in the United States, and it's the time when we were relegated to that wasteland of frequencies, 200 meters and down. And turns out we don't really need all that bandwidth. And then, of course, in 1914, the ARRL was founded, and if you're an ARRL member, you probably have already heard about this, but you'll be hearing a lot more about the various celebrations and activities surrounding the centennial of the ARRL. Now, one other thing I mentioned, I invoked DIY. The old-timers today will say, you know, nobody builds stuff anymore. Where's the real spirit of amateur radio and all that? In QST, there was this is a quote I found. In those days, the author was talking about his misspent youth. In those days, nothing could be bought. Everything had to be made. And he was winding coils on oatmeal boxes, and he was making capacitors with window glass and things like that. That dates from March 1916. So my claim is that nothing ever changes. This is a principle of historic invariance. The world is going to the dogs, and it always has been. It still is today. There's always been this tension between folks who do it themselves and folks who buy components ready-made. I don't think that's changing too much. You can find a lot of interest in do-it-yourself in terms of antennas and QRP rigs and all kinds of stuff. In the biblical times, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. And I'm going to talk about this thing that you've never heard of, maybe. I hadn't really until I started getting into this. First of all, this is a sort of thumbnail sketch of the history of amateur radio. We started off with Spark in the very early 1900s. And then around World War I, everything was suspended for the war. But afterwards, the spark had more or less disappeared by the early 20s. CW came on strong, mainly because Audions, the first vacuum tubes, were available to make CW transmitters possible and receivers. And we also had AM coming on strong, AM broadcast and amateur AM as well. And World War II came along. There was more another suspension. Single sideband started up around late 40s, early 50s. FM came along for mobile, VHF, and other activities. And then in my simple sketch here, the last thing that's happened that's kind of interesting is software-defined radio. So there, I've mentioned software-defined radio. That's everything in my abstract. I've fulfilled my job today, but maybe we can go a little further. And what sparked my interest, what really got this going, was a piece of equipment that I found in ARRL headquarters in the museum that's being set up right now. If you've taken the tour at Newington, you know there's a lot of old equipment that was sort of displayed in random cabinets around the building. Now it's being coordinated and curated and made into a rather nice little museum where you can see almost the whole history of amateur radio from the earliest days of Spark all the way through to 60s and 70s at least, and a couple of operating stations from selected era. For instance, a novice station from the 1960s or 70s, which might have been the first station for many of us. You can sit down and operate it. But what I discovered was this funny piece of equipment. And it turns out that was published in 1932 QST under the name as a single signal receiver. Today you talk about selectivity, of course, and you talk about sideband rejection, image rejection, and so on for a receiver. But it was not so obvious in the early days that's what we were talking about at all. Of course, starting out with SPARC, you were dealing with signals that were 100 kilohertz wide or more. So selectivity was not possible in that kind of an environment. So I went to the headquarters library, which is a really kind of a small room, but what's there is very interesting. When I got into ham radio in the early 50s, you could still actually hold a handbook in one hand. It turns out the folks at headquarters, in the lab in particular, are very interested in old radio, and they're really, they know a lot, and they're very keen to talk to you about any of these issues.
You're listening to an excerpt from a 2012 Dayton Hamvention talk by ARRL technical advisor Martin Ewing, AA6E. We'll continue his look at the single signal problem of the 1930s and 40s in a moment. This is The Rain Report, available as a podcast from therainreport.com.
Now, the single signal problem. There was a series of articles published by James Lamb in QST in the early 30s describing what was wrong with their CW receivers, how they could be improved. That actually defined the communications receiver as we have known it since these papers were published up until the late 90s, perhaps, when SDR came along. In the 30s, we had CW, we had SPARC, got rid of SPARC. We had AM phone. We had lots and lots of operators, lots and lots of QRM. We had good technology. We had lots of vacuum tubes available, new types of vacuum tubes. We had receivers of various levels of sophistication, and the QRM was becoming intolerable because the receivers were rather low quality, and they had low selectivity. And just to remind you that we're talking about vacuum tubes, those of the current generation of getting into the hobby may be surprised that the number of vacuum tubes was a measure of how good a radio you had. And it's just kind of hard to believe now that your desktop computer probably has a billion transistors in it. So what's this about one vacuum tube? It's just like one transistor, right? So it's just not a significant thing, although it was a very significant thing for the early ham. If you see something with three knobs on the front, there's a good chance, and four tubes. It's a very simple user interface. There's a volume control, there's a regeneration control, and there's a tuning control and a dial. And to the side in the back somewhere there's a jack for your headset for phones, and there's interchangeable coils behind to change bands. That was the radio in those days that you might expect to find on a typical ham's desk. What's the problem with this? These are early tubes. This is a type 22 and a type 01 triode. They're directly heated cathodes. They're filaments. So this is what they call the DC set. You had to use DC on the filaments or you'd have a terrible hum problem. Somewhat later generation would have indirectly heated cathodes and you could use AC on your filaments, and they were called AC sets. You have an untuned RF amplifier as the first stage, which surprised me. I didn't realize we ever did that sort of thing with an untuned stage. There's a regenerative detector where most of the action really occurs, amplification and signal detection, and two stages of audio with an audio filter peaked at about 1 kilohertz to provide, as they call it, some selectivity, but not a lot. So a regenerative detector, you may be familiar with how it works. It's an amplifier with feedback. So there's a little tickler coil here that's feeding back the output into the input stage. It's tuned to the frequency of interest you're trying to receive. And there's a regeneration control which controls the gain of that stage. The trick is to increase the gain until it adds gain to the whole circuit so your signal gets louder and your bandpass narrows down and eventually it breaks into oscillation. And that's what you want, of course, because you're probably receiving CW and you need to use this stage as your beat frequency oscillator. And you need to tune it off by a few hundred hertz or whatever from the desired signal. And all these controls tend to interact in interesting ways. And by today's standards, it's more of an art to operate this type of receiver. And you still, of course, can buy regen kits nowadays with transistors and so on. It's basically the same idea. What's the problem with this kind of a radio? The advantages and disadvantages are you've got a very simple circuit. It's pretty sensitive, surprisingly so, given the few tubes that it has. It'll do CW or voice AM. For AM, of course, you don't want the detector to be oscillating. And you don't want very, very narrow bandwidth either. The problems are that it's not stable. You have to tweak the knobs. If you tune to a different frequency, you have to adjust the regeneration and so on. And if your battery voltage changes, then you've got to tweak things and so on. It doesn't have much selectivity, but the real issue is it's got a double signal problem. And that is, it's sensitive to both sidebands around the oscillator. You have a green, maybe that's a desired signal. You've got some QRM over here, and the audio, they get folded together. One's on top of the other. That's the double signal problem, and that was a fact of life for hams in the 1930s. That was the way you operated for the most part. There were some superhet receivers. There were some advanced receivers people were working with, but the common one had this sort of problem. And so here comes James Lamb. He developed, at least in terms of the history that's visible in the pages of QST, which I don't claim to be a historian. I haven't done a very wide search. But I think QST is a pretty good record of where we were in the hobby. He combined some elements that he found in various products and laboratories and combined them in a way that was appropriate for amateur radio. What he combined was a super heterodyne design. In your IF amplifier, you had the ability to control the bandpass response, to do the B frequency detector as a separate oscillator, and so on. A tuned RF amplifier stage. The advantage of tuning it, of course, is it's a preselector, so it gets rid of the interference that's somewhat distant from your desired signal. He had a stable VFO for the main tuning and a BFO for B frequency oscillator using more advanced design strategy. He had shielded construction, because when you have a radio with lots of gain, you have to be very careful that the later stages aren't feeding back into the earlier stages. He has a crystal filter in the IF. So none of these in itself was brand new, but he combined them in an interesting way. There's an article by Brian Page describing the National HRO receiver. He attributes most of the design innovations that came on this commercial radio, which you can still find out in the flea market, I'm sure, a really collector's item, using the principles that were developed first for the Lamb radio. So there it is. That's how it was published in 1932.
This concludes our excerpt from a 2012 Dayton Hamvention talk by ARRL technical advisor Martin Ewing, AA6E, given during a forum about a low-math approach to understanding software-defined radio, SDR, and an evolution of radio designs from the 1930s to the present. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2012 Rain, all rights reserved. Now for Rain's founder and producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.